The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Annie Leontes is the author of the debut novel Let Me Explain You, which was featured as an editor's choice in the New York Times Book Review. She's the co-editor of the anthology A Manner of Being, Writers on Their Mentors, and the interview series The Gloss appears in Bomb, The Believer, and Electric Literature. Annie joins us this evening with her new book, Sex with a Brain Injury, a personal memoir in essays. She'll be joined in conversation with C.J. Hauser, author most recently of The Crane Wife. Please welcome Annie and C.J. to the Free Library.
Gotta love Philly. We're already screaming. Wow. Yeah, go Birds. Thank you all for being here. It means so much to me to see so many people I love and people I don't yet know, but I'm sure will love soon. You know, just a couple years ago, this kind of gathering would have been nearly impossible for me, like the lights and like listening to people's coats moving, and I wouldn't have been able to do it. So it's really a celebration to be back here with all of you and with the community. And I wouldn't have been able to heal as much as I have without the support of you all, and I certainly wouldn't have been able to write this book. So I appreciate that. I want to dedicate tonight's reading to the walking wounded, which is the moniker for people who are living with brain injuries, and also my nephew Giovanni, who can't be here tonight, but who we love dearly. I also, just if you'll bear with me, just a couple people to thank. First, my wife, Sarah, who this book is dedicated to, who we all know and love. Without her, the book would have no plot, but neither would my life. And, you know, this is a real love, and I'm so glad we get to share it with the world. I'm also, just want to appreciate my family of origin and my queer family who carry me, as always, all my family members up front, holding it down for the first row. And a couple friends I want to shout out, Kate McLaughlin and Lito Velasquez, who scrape me off the ground and keep me going. Lito and I actually co-host a podcast called Lit Friends. I won't be mad if you take out your phone and follow us right now. It's a literary podcast. We invite two writers who are friends on and off the page in real life to have a conversation about art and making one's way as a writer. And we launched with Justin Torres and Angela Flournoy, and most recently had Melissa Phoebos and Danica Kelly on. So we hope you'll join us for that. There's a million people behind the scenes that make a book possible. I'm gonna thank them in spirit and just call out a couple of names. Kara Watson, my editor, who really went to bat for this book. Georgia Brainerd, my publicist. Kate Lloyd, who is here in the audience. Where are you, Kate? Just so we can give you love. Yay, love you, Kate. CJ, of course, who is queer fam and compatriot and offered to be in conversation. Art Fung, who made the assets for the visuals. Of course, my communities, The Claw, which is here in full force. My Q's mob, the TBI community. Drexel Jim, believe it or not, there are all kinds of people who help you get through. I don't know if Panina is here yet, but her class is amazing, take it. And then healers who have really made a difference for me, including Catherine Slyman. I don't know if Catherine's here yet. There's Catherine, a miracle worker and a witch. Dr. Reynada, is Reynada here? Okay, she will be. She rolls in late. And then Dr. Siobhan Gibbons. So, okay, enough with the thank yous. If I left you off the list, I hope you'll give me some grace with a title like Sex with a Brain Injury. I'm going to do two very brief readings and just talk a little, very briefly about the book, and then CJ and I will talk for a few minutes and then open it up to questions. So I wrote this book after I had a series of head injuries in 2016, 2017. They basically, I had three in a year, and they became pretty intractable and changed my relationship to writing and living, and things just got pretty hard. And it's a kind of book that demanded to be written because TBI is this invisible condition and it demands language even when language is hard to come by. And so I wrote this book in part with bell hooks in mind when she says, I'm most interested in confessional writing when it allows us to move into the personal as a way to go beyond it. I evoke the personal as a prelude. So good to have her in the room too. So I'm going to read the first piece from the book, just a snippet of it called The Life Cycle of a Concussion, and then I'll read an excerpt from a different piece. The Life Cycle of a Concussion. It starts with a big bang. It comes from the sky, a meteor, a falling object, a box. It comes out of nowhere, a car, a baseball, an opponent's fist, a partner's fist, an officer's baton, a player's helmet, the band Kani Basami throw during the girls' judo tournament, a skateboard crash, a roller coaster, the blast of an IED, a low-sitting shelf, a low-hanging branch, a rogue wave, a 2x4. Or you fall off your bike on a quiet road. You do not pass out. You aren't likely to. Less than 10% of concussions result in loss of consciousness. Later, you will wish you had passed out for just a minute or two as proof to you and everybody else that something happened. You will secretly wish that there was blood, not too much blood, not like a whole brain bleed, just like a touch of Halloween-style makeup. Your brain, which is the texture of butter, ricochets around in its own liquids. It slams against the wall of the skull. The axons that connect the white matter of the brain, each a tiny filament less than 1/100th a human hair in diameter, tear and fray. The headaches, the dizziness, these will come soon enough. Right now you're freaked because something is up with your eyes. You were told by the cartoons that you'd see stars, but actually the world is retreating, as if the air is taffy being pulled and stretched, the world in present tense, and you several seconds behind. Your friend answers the phone call you don't remember making, scrapes you off the pavement, stealing glances at you in the passenger seat because he's nervous you'll fall asleep or worse. You try to be the same person you were before you fell off your bike, crack a joke about how hard your head must be, only you're not sure if you actually spoke out loud or if you said the joke twice or if your friend was actually the one who made the joke. This is called, you are told, confusion. At the hospital, if you're lucky, you get put through a CAT scan. This CAT scan does not show a thing because technology cannot yet detect the microscopic axonal injury of concussion. The scans come back normal. The formal diagnosis is traumatically induced transient disturbance of brain function, but the people who treat you now and in the coming months interchangeably use the words concussion, mild head trauma, and traumatic brain injury, so that when you leave with the paper that says what you have and what you should do, which you cannot read, why can't you read? You're in the Acorn group in second grade, which means you've been praised for your reading abilities since age 7, and I'm pretty sure you've only gotten better since then. You are lost. You realize you have no idea what a concussion is, really. You return to work because the pamphlet says you should be good in 2 or 3 days. Here come the headaches, the sensation that your head is full of gauze, distortions in your periphery. You catch the start of people's sentences, but by the time they get to the question you're supposed to answer, or the thing you're supposed to remember the next time you see your colleague or boss, you forget what's been said. You still can't read. The words on the page refuse each other like oil and water. So you fake it. When you do finally get reading back, you can't recall what the paragraph is about when you get to the bottom. You can't draw a clock. The numbers get all bunched up, 7 to 12 crammed together like condiments on a fridge shelf. And that is definitely not where the 6 goes. Even your little nephew knows the 6. You walk outside on your lunch break and the sun brings new hurt. The whooshing cars, screaming birds, the trash truck, snippets of chatter, lawnmower, it's all a grind in your head. You have to cross the street because the guy in front of you is wearing a neon patterned shirt. Your mother calls you. You can't listen to her for 2 minutes before nausea sets in. Sorry, moms. Okay, I'm going to read one more excerpt. This is called Dancing in the Dark. So I had a pretty complicated relationship with my biological mother. I thought we really were nothing alike. She was queer and struggled with addiction for most of her life. And then I learned from my personal experience as well as research that actually the addicted brain and the injured brain look very much alike. And when I discovered this, I was like, I was reckoning with it, I was in the middle of like walking down a street in Philadelphia and I just like stopped in my tracks. Because the universe was just like, you know, forcing me to really understand and think about what her experience must have been like. So this piece, which I think is maybe one of the most intimate pieces in the book, grapples with that quite a bit. And I'm thinking about that amazing TED Talk by Melissa Phoebos, where she says, you have to meet the gaze of your past self and ask her questions that sometimes we spend our whole lives avoiding asking, and then you have to listen to her answers. This is Dancing in the Dark. The two things we had in common, women and dancing, Mary in baggy jeans, sneakers, and a long black t-shirt, me in a baseball cap, a shirt with a collar, cleavage, rainbow beads on my wrist. She was excited to take me partying, to get me my first tattoo, things she thought a mother should do for a daughter to prove that, even after years of absence, she had been there the whole time. My cousins came to the gay club that night, my friends too. I sipped watered-down vodka from a plastic cup, thinking this is what legal vodka tasted like. I leaned against the cement column, hoping my posture suggested, no big deal, I am often surrounded by this many hot lesbians. In reality, I'd only been to a couple of gay bars, and at 22, I wasn't ready for tonight. The colored lights cutting the floor, the upholstery scent of clothing rubbing together, music rumbling up my spine, prowling women in the shadows, and the building expectation of the crowd, the glint of gold teeth and cheap, low-hanging jewelry. Mary and I had reconnected after years of estrangement. This place was her idea. She knew the bouncer, the bartender, the women posted at the bathroom doors who watched us come and go. Mary was a good dancer, had been a DJ. We both loved Madonna, rap, anything with a thumping beat, but she was not dancing with us. She hovered at the edge of the floor, sipping her Sprite, a big, unmissable woman. She was looking, laughing. Her forehead glistened with sweat, her thick black hair glossy. I followed her gaze across the floor to us, to my friend. She was watching my friend, going, damn, she's sexy. Damn, look at that girl move. My mother pinning my friend with her eyes the way I'd seen some men do to women from their car windows. If I close my eyes, I can picture her in the spray of lights nodding to the beat, the mole on her cheek, the way her big body shifts as if in permanent exile. She's Ursula the Sea Witch, short black hair, thick body, hard jaw, outrageous mouth. Her eyes have been known to scare children, her mannishness to scare off men. She is a dyke, an addict at a time when people with substance abuse disorders have no place in America. She loses friends to AIDS in the 80s, loses friends to overdose in the 90s. She's in and out of rehab. She takes in young women when they have no place to go and then demands with at least one of them that they pay her in sex. She is lonely much of her life. She does not like to discuss what drugs she was on when she was pregnant with me. She left my father when I was 2, my sister 1, so she could finally have a life. I am a reminder of a time before she was free, and I am also what remains of the daughter she had to give up in order to claim herself. She always wanted me more than I wanted her. That is, when she wanted me at all. Me, my whole life, I wanted nothing to be like her. When she dies, not yet 60, I mistakenly believe I've escaped her. The judge declared Mary an unfit mother. It's easy to criminalize a woman in America, just say she doesn't take care of her kids. This is particularly persuasive if she's a lesbian, an addict, a foreigner. My father understood why a man might leave everything and come to a new country to have a better life. But he did not understand how 2 crying babies fit into that, especially when there was no woman to hand them off to. My sister and I were sent to Greece to live on an island with my father's family until he could find another woman to take care of us. I might at times forget my address or bank card PIN, but I'll always remember the day I returned to the States, my sister and I hiding behind our father, the unfamiliar cousins and adults gawking at us. I knew how to say one phrase in English, I'm hungry. But I was too afraid to speak. Our father introduced us to our new family, a new sister, one who, like me, was entering kindergarten, another soon enough on the way, and most importantly, a new mom, the woman who opened her home to two little Greek girls and told them women can be whatever they want, that they can even drive a car. Mary was wild, liked to party, as my father would say. He warned all addicts are lowlifes. His fingernails were black from welding. His work clothes all had burn holes. He wanted me to have a good life, a productive life, not working in dirty shops like him or sweating over an olive farm like his father, who made it no farther than the fourth grade. I could hear the tremor in his voice when he said it. You're very smart, like your father, so be successful. The worst is to be anything like Mary. Eat that, you'll have an ass like Mary. Wear that, you'll look too much like Mary. Think that, and eventually you'll be exactly a mother who gave up her own children. Do you want to be the one they all point at? Do you want to be the man of women? Will you be the reason that normal women look at you with resentment, since they have to deal with men all the time and you do not? For years, I told myself I was not gay. I liked Nicky A even after he accidentally stabbed me in the eye with a wooden sword on a sixth grade trip to medieval times. You all know what I'm talking about. Where we ate a thin potato soup and a tiny Cornish hen I got to dismantle with my bare hands. That wasn't gay, right? My sexual fantasy of being a logger come home to find my woman waiting by the fire, that did not make me gay. Neither did the one about being a soldier during the Civil War come home to his almost widow waiting by the fire. Or the one about Axl Rose, where I'm Axl Rose fucking Axl Rose. It's my family in the front row. I couldn't be gay because in each of these, I was the man. The girl who lived down the block and who sometimes saw Mary said, "What's a lesbo?" I tried to tell her, but she kept saying, "What do you mean? What do you mean?" I wrote it down thinking that was the problem. I drew arrows to prove the point that would undermine heteronormativity. Her mother, doing the wash, found the sheet of folded notebook paper in her jeans. Her mother called up my house, said, "We don't use those kinds of words." The words on the page were girl, girl, lesbian. Years into adulthood, I assume the gender of delicate man. I shoot for George Michael. I end up looking more like one of my Greek uncles. Thank you. Thank you so much. So I just want to make a brief announcement because I will forget. One is, if you didn't do the little poll when you were coming in, feel free to do that now. There's like little slips of paper coming around. And then, what was the other thing? The other thing is we have an after party for those of you who want to come out. It's at Broad Hall. It should be a really good time. Some of you have already offered to buy me a drink. I humbly cannot accept, but I hope you will use those funds to support people in need in Gaza. And just give me a hug.
Come over here. Hi, Annie.
Hi, CJ.
So my students taught me this thing, which is that when we have class and we talk about readings or we talk about things that people have written, when I'm excited about something, all I want to do is ask a million questions. And my students told me that was rude. And what they think is less rude is that before you get into the questions, you're like, oh, holy fuck, someone made a thing. It's a miracle, and we should celebrate that. So can we celebrate that Annie's book came out this week? She made it. The Youngs know things. We learn from the Youngs. All right, so you've heard some of the book. Many of you have read sections of this book before, but to sort of introduce it, yes, this is a book about traumatic brain injury, but it's one of my favorite things about this book is that it's operating on so many different levels and so many different registers. It's personal and it's researched. Part of it is co-written collaboratively with Markel Taylor, You're talking about queer joy, and you're talking about Henry VIII. You're writing poetry, and you're writing activist nonfiction about medical inequities, and it just inspires the hell out of me to think, like, nonfiction can be all of these things, and, like, one book can contain all of those things, and it can still feel like I moved through this really unified, intentional experience. So, like, can we just, like, sing a love song for nonfiction, like, what it can do and what it felt like to sort of occupy all these registers?
Yeah, of course. And I, you know, CJ also moved from fiction to nonfiction and shifts. So I'd love to hear that you talk about this too. I'm a very reluctant nonfiction writer. I just thought I was going to live in the world of fiction. But what I've come to appreciate, especially about creative nonfiction, is that it feels like it's poised to change the culture in kind of amazing ways that I think fiction and the novel can do, right? But there's something so raw and honest about the experience. I mean, like, you know, I'm here in my meat sack, and you're there in your meat sack, and you are all meat sacks, and we have no idea what your experience is like or what's going on in your head. And the only way we really get to that, to, like, outside of the existential isolation and loneliness, is through language, and especially, you know, writing. And because creative nonfiction offers this kind of catharsis, right? Like, not the idea that I just have to get this thing off my chest, but, like, I will extend myself as a nonfiction writer and share this experience, and then you join me in that. And that joining is really powerful and feels like catharsis. And just one other thought is that, I talk about this in the book a little bit. There's this amazing comedian, Tig Notaro. I don't know if you all have... All right, great. Yeah, we love Tig Notaro. I'm going to totally ruin the special if you haven't seen it, but you should still watch it anyway. We'll not dole it. But I teach this lesson in my creative nonfiction class where, you know, Tig Notaro started as a comedian who was really, like, sardonic and had, like, dark humor, but really observational and kind of up here, just, like, judging the rest of humanity. And then she got breast cancer, lost her mother, and her girlfriend left her, like, all at the same time. And it changed her relationship to her comedy tremendously, and she began to write very autobiographically, and you know this. So in this special, she kind of makes this joke about, like, doing the show topless, and then ends up taking off her shirt, actually, and was not someone who had reconstructive surgery. So what you see is, like, a very scarred, healing, queer body. And I showed that section to my students. I showed that segment when we were talking about the power of creative nonfiction. And the conversation we had was like, how do you feel being confronted by this person taking this risk and joining you in this way? Like, do you feel pity? Do you feel like they are weak? And to a person, they all were astounded by her strength and her power. Like, she has this incredible ethos and pathos, being able to pull the audience. I mean, there's, like, no oxygen in the room when she's doing this. And it shows, like, the actual power of vulnerability.
And, like, she's so authoritative in that moment. And I think, like, at the beginning of that special, she does this sort of normal, shaky comedic thing where she's like, oh, like, let me tell you a joke about a bee driving down the freeway in Los Angeles. And then she's like, you know what? Actually, I can't talk about this. Like, here's what's actually going on with me. And she lapses into the skit. And at the end, she's like, do you want to hear the joke about the bee? And then she goes back into it, and it feels completely different. And I feel like the way authority happens in different modes is a thing that you do so well in this text. Like, there are these moments where, like, you have done all this research and you know all these things now, and, like, you're really generously informing the reader about facts, and it feels very authoritative. And then we'll drop into a more, like, really intimate moment, like one of the ones you were just reading. I don't know, were you aware as you were structuring the book that you were, like, playing with, like, when you were dropping into intimacy? Because I felt the authority carry through all of it, which, like, I don't know if I've had the guts to do in nonfiction before. It's scary.
It's so scary. And I'm, like, the last person who ever thought I could write, like, a critical essay or, like, you know, I'm like, my library skills are not as good as they should be. But I feel like you do it too. Like, I feel like you're doing a kind of blending to tell the story. So how do you feel about the power of creative nonfiction?
I was like, Annie, this is your event. And then he's like, I'm going to ask you questions. You see what's happening. Okay, so what I do is I go out and I drink one cocktail and I'm like, I am Hunter S. Thompson and I am doing journalism. And then I just go ask people a bunch of crazed questions and then I write it down and I'm like, is this journalism now? So that's how I do it. This book feels a lot more in control of itself.
We just fake it. And I should say, my high school English teacher is in the audience, John Scribonian, so he taught me a lot about it.
Whoop, whoop. All right. There is a whole chapter of this book. I want to ask you about Markel Taylor.
Yes.
Period.
Love it.
But so there's a whole chapter of this book, for those of you who haven't read it yet, which is probably most of you because it just came out, that is co-written, collaboratively written with Markel Taylor. And I think collaboration is so exciting these days. Like, I love working with scientists. I love working with artists and other mediums. And so can you just tell us about what it means to have, like, co-authored this whole section with a second person for this book? How did you meet him? What should we know about him? What would he want people to hear today if he could have been with us?
Yeah, and actually, Markel, we were going to try to get him to call in. But he lost his brother this week, so unfortunately he's not able to do that. But he's here in spirit. He's the most amazing hype man. He would have taken the show. You know, so disability justice, right, is like, it's a movement that's really collaborative, integrative, inclusive, and like wants to be represented by the people, you know, telling their own stories, And initially, you know, when I started doing this research for this book, I just was asking the question, you know, if this happened to me, you know, who else did it happen to? What don't we know? Who don't we see? And what needs to kind of rise to the surface in changing our cultural awareness and consciousness around brain injury? And I stumbled on the research of Dr. Kim Gorgon. She has this like amazing TED Talk. You should definitely go check it out. She's like incredible. And I learned that, this is from the poll, so this will be interesting to see. I learned that people who are incarcerated are 7 times more likely to have a head injury before they get to prison. That's like 80%. Before, right? So we think of like prisons as dangerous, violent spaces, which of course they are. What we don't necessarily have the awareness of is that we incarcerate mental illness in this country. TBI happens to be one of the most invisible, you know, versions of that, or you know, causation of that. So I found that research. Kim introduced me to Markel. I thought it was just going to be an interview. And then we started talking. Like, the first time we met, we just immediately were laughing and talking really loud, which is how I know I connect with somebody.
Nice.
As the group person. And it went from interview to like, oh, I'm going to do a profile or a feature on him, to something like, no, we have to co-author this. You know, like, this has to be a dialogic space. And initially I was like, do you want to just write it together? And he's like, no, you're the writer. So he did a lot of like oral storytelling, and we did this over months. And it's why it's like the most important piece for me. And I should say that part of the subject for Markel, so Markel Taylor is a Denver businessman, carceral justice advocate, and served 20 years in the system. And while he was in prison, he wrote into law legislation that ensures neuropsychological screenings for people in Colorado who are about to be sentenced. It's like very cutting edge. No other state is doing this work. And he used the research and, you know, the work he was doing. I mean, he's a very smart man. He used it to free himself and has since gone on to do the work. He started an initiative called Rebuild Your Mind, and is doing all kinds of work around TBI, right? And some of that means, you know, because of the law he helped write, they're doing a pilot program now at a prison for cis women in Colorado, focusing specifically on women, because 97 to 99% of people who are incarcerated in women's prisons likely had a head injury in the preceding year. Like, you can't, those numbers are astounding. So now, you know, Markel and I are, like, we're friends, right? Like, we share, like, he told me he got engaged. I shared news about the book. I'm gonna go out there and do an event in Denver. Yeah, and it's just, thank you for asking about it because it's really important to me.
I was like, especially, as like an X-Men nerd, I especially loved, like, that chapter is called Professor X and the Trauma Justice League.
Uh-huh.
And then you are Rogue of Novelism.
Yeah.
And so you guys have these X-Men, like, loving, like,
him.
Mutant power nicknames for each other. Mm-hmm. How did you guys discover you were both X-Men fans?
Like, I think immediately. I think it was like, he was wearing a Dallas cap. I was like, I'm an Eagles fan. And then we talked about X-Men. wait, which X-Man are you?
Gambit.
Oh,
I mean, like, maybe that's like, who do I wish I was? I don't know. We can't get this deep up here, but like, I, aspirational Gambit.
Yeah. New poll, which X-Man
are
you?
New poll, which X-Man are you? Oh, that's really amazing. Is there anything you think that he always tries to say when y'all are doing our events or when he was doing all of the work to get the legislation passed that you want to say here today? I mean, it's all in the book. But.
What he was saying. I mean, I think what he was really saying is, like, we're here. Just because you can't see us, you know, we're here.
Yeah.
And I think he's talking on behalf of a lot of people who don't have access to justice.
Yeah. Yeah. I think some of the statistics you just told us about, like, TBI among incarcerated individuals are really, really striking to me.
Yeah.
I was not aware of that before. And I learned a lot in this book. Mm-hmm. And I think you have done, like, a really generous job of, like, researching and communicating to people who either need this information, should know this information, all sorts of stuff. So I'm wondering, like, the current state of the science around this, racial and gender disparity in the research. So are there facts and concepts that you most hope people will understand better after reading this book? I'm basically inviting you to do like a PSA here.
Yeah, I mean, I did geek out on this book because it was like, you know, once I learned about like the prison research, I looked at history and then I looked at philosophy and I looked at the NFL, and this is kind of an aside, but like so many you know, we have a false understanding of TBI and false narratives about TBI because our culture doesn't actually understand them. And there are all of these, there's a lot of mythology and myth making around it because of Hollywood and special interests like NFL. Like, I was reading a case study and it was basically like, post-concussive syndrome isn't real. And then the disclaimer or the like, what is that? The note where you have to reveal as a researcher your...
like your biases?
Yeah, or like who you work for.
Oh.
And it was like, New York Jets. I was like, come on. So so there's a lot that's shaping our understanding of it. And a lot of this book was saying, like, let's keep turning this thing and keep looking at it. And I really think that in some regard, this is very similar to the cultural shift for smoking and tobacco, right? Like, we knew the data, we had the data for decades, and then 1964, the Surgeon General warning comes out every year since, but in the 80s, people are still smoking on planes and in schools and in hospitals, right? And, like, can you imagine getting on a plane now with, like, a smoke-filled plane? Like, that seems barbaric. And it wasn't until the 2010s that we start changing legislation at the state level, and it feels like right now with head injury, we're at that tipping point where, like, the culture needs to shift and understand these narratives differently. So that's a long-winded way of saying, like, I feel like that's what all of the research in the book is trying to do. Some quick hits, no pun intended. thanks. I do one a day. It's like, I can't help myself. Females who play soccer are twice as likely as males to get post-concussive disorder. We don't know why. Nods in the room. I feel like you have children who have had these problems, or you have had these problems. You had the problem. Yeah. Yeah. I always get a female soccer player in the audience. Well, this is also astounding, and one I couldn't spend that much time on because I just don't have the expertise, but one in every two people who are housing insecure had a head injury before they lost their homes. And then the last thing I'll say before you get to choose your adventure
yeah.
of a little reading, is part of the cultural framework of doubt around the condition is, like, yes, it's invisible, and, like, your friends can't see what you're going through, really, and your partner can't, and, you know, it's very easy to be like, is this all in this person's head? But in doing research, I learned that actually this relationship to doubt in the medical industry, particularly around TBI, happens with the advent of the railroad, right? This is when we start to believe that people are trying to scam the system. Essentially, right, we invent the railroad. Human beings have never traveled at this speed before. Railroads are a mess when they're first. There's no standard gauge. There's no standard timetable. Trains will run on a single track, like in both directions. Cars and cables derail all the time. Charles Dickens, his train derailed, and it went over a ravine, except his didn't. but he writes in a letter about how he was not right after that. He calls it the railway shaking. And so these railroad tycoons and insurance start to buy up these doctors to call it factitious PTSD. And now, I mean, that's really like the historical anchor and framework for why we doubt it, right? It's personal, it's interpersonal, it's like what we see, don't see, but it's also historical.
I was gonna be like, I love this Charles Dickens fact, but like, sorry, Charles, I actually hate this Charles Dickens fact.
Yeah.
But now we get to choose our own adventure, because there are two sections that Annie might read from, and you have a choice as the audience to learn some facts, to hear some more reading. Do you want to go Rageful King or Healing Witch? It's very hard to decide, I know.
If you buy the book, you get both.
Say the same. If you buy the book, you get both. All right, everyone who is Raging King. I see some Raging King. Okay, Healing Witch.
Oh.
I feel like the Healing Witch was more powerful than the Raging King. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank God. The Raging King is Henry VIII, and I will... is that right? Yes, Henry VIII. And I will just say that Yale, in like 2019, concluded that he had what football players have, CTE, and that was largely responsible for his bloodthirst. So he had three concussions. After the third one in like 15, 36, maybe, he is not the same after that. He was like a good-looking, like fun, benevolent ruler. And then he has three jousting head injuries, and after that becomes bloodthirsty, and it's in the same year as his head injury that the like worst violence happens. So it's like a baffling under known, I guess, fact. Okay, the witch, the healing witch. I will tell you a story that you might not believe. I go to a witch. She is certified in a hands-on technique that uses light touch to move the fluids of the central nervous system and palpate the synarthroidal joints of the cranium. The witch says to me, "What would it look like to be better?" I'm not sure how to answer this, so I say, "Tequila?" She laughs, "That's what everybody says." The witch is not the same witch each time. Sometimes she has a French accent. Sometimes her teeth are crooked, other times straight and white. I trust her because she's not precious about healing like other healers, and because the look in her eye reminds me of Dr. G. The sign on the window says she does this same technique on babies, and I think I would be a big baby not to at least give it a try. But also, she has been hurt like I have been hurt. For her, it was jumping out of planes and subsequent whiplash. Years later, on her birthday at the beach, she will be hurt yet again when a wave knocks her over. Let's call it one rogue wave. The treatment is not cheap. I'm lucky to have found the witch, lucky to be able to pay for this. I think about how many people need the witch but can't get to her. The witch works on my head. It means hardly moving a muscle, hers or mine. It happens over many months, then years, as does my learning to let her into the in-between. You are still in fight or flight, she says. Your cells are buzzing. Your parasympathetic system is the jack we have to put in the box. There's some kind of black spot behind your left eye. Those light switches you ran into, they had teeth. Together, wordlessly, the witch and I find open spaces for us both to enter, a touch that goes where language cannot. Some days it feels like surgery. Some days she puts her hands in my mouth. People comment how light my eyes look after a session. My best friend asks, does it feel like deep tissue? No, more like when the dentist is drilling and the Novocaine starts to wear off. I leave the first session and go eat a baked potato, and it is the best baked potato I've ever eaten. It makes every other baked potato seem like pulp. I curl up on the couch, lying there as if I've recently been beaten. Despite instructions for rest, I write for hours. Without the witch, I doubt I would have been able to say any of this. One day, the witch goes very still. I feel it, the frozen spike in my head, 1,000 years old. I don't realize it just yet. Another millennia will go by before I do. But the witch has felt it too, this invisible thing between us, lodged in my skull. She hesitates. She will later tell me that when she does this, people sometimes throw up on her. But first, an eternity passes. Then the witch swipes at the air and, without even touching me, yanks the spike right out. I cry out a word never spoken before. Let's call it reincarnation.
Oh, I love that section so much. I think I only have time to ask you one more question.
Dealer's choice.
Dealer's choice?
Gambit's choice.
Gambit's choice. Okay, Gambit's choice is this. I think the work of nonfiction is so often to make all, at least for me, is like all of the lived-in impossible things to communicate that I feel like I can't express, expressible and knowable to someone else. And I feel like you're doing that in this book on a personal level in terms of just your human being who's expressing yourself, but also in terms of like an invisible pain. And using this book, especially in that passage, to do it so beautifully and powerfully. I don't know, can you talk about the power of nonfiction to sort of, ooh, there's a Ralph Ellison quote, there it is. Lo, the invisible made visible. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a dubious joke when he says it in the book. He's like, everyone else saw this before, y'all are late to the party. And so I feel like you are lo, the invisible made visible here for us.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I wasn't sure how people would receive this book, but I will say what's been astounding is that people have been reaching out already, just like going to my website and writing like little letters, and they're sharing their experiences because I shared my experience, and it's been really like incredible just to see that happen, you know, just to hear that all of them just talk about how alone they have felt. And some of them write not even just to tell me their story, but to be like, oh, I heard about your suffering through TBI. This worked for me. Which is just like amazing. Like,
yeah.
They don't need to do that, you know? And maybe they're suffering more than I am. But it's just like this power to connect people. It's like why we do it.
I can't wait for all of you to read this book. Can you join me in thanking Annie for writing it and for chatting with us? All right. I think now is the time where if you have questions, you will ask them and you will raise your hand and then miraculously a microphone will appear.
Hey, Annie.
Hey.
It's Jack.
Hey, Jack.
So I heard, just to contextualize for other folks, I heard the interview with Annie on NPR. I'm sure a lot of people did.
Whoop, whoop.
And it was brought to my attention. My girlfriend was actually listening to it, and she was like, oh, you need to listen to this. She's like, you have a brain injury, and you like having sex. And so she sent it to me, and I started listening to it, and I was like, I didn't realize initially that I knew you, and then I realized that I was like, oh, I know this person.
And yeah, not only are we were neighbors, yeah. But we had the same birthday.
Yeah, same brain injury, same birthday, mm-hmm. Same a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And it was, as you're saying now, it was so, I obviously haven't read the book yet. I'm We all are about to buy a copy.
Yes.
And I was so struck, though, just listening to speak with Terry Gross about it, like how, and you were just saying, like how affirming it was to hear you speak about your experience, not only of writing the book, but sort of the stories within the book, because it feels so isolating. So I've had like more concussions than I care to enumerate. And it's similar to your story. I had like one really bad blow to the head and then a second one. And by the third one, in your interview, you talk about like, you know, you shake the orange juice and you like have a concussion. And that's like, today I like moved too quickly and I, you know. And when my girlfriend sent me the interview, I was so struck by how affirming it was just that she had heard it. I was like, oh, okay, this is like, this is on NPR. Like, this is real. Like, if there was any doubt whether or not I was making this shit up. Because it's like, it's hard. It's like, I'll like lay down too quickly in bed and then I'm like, I have a concussion again. And I sent it to everybody that I know. And partly it's because I'm like, this seems like an incredible book. I think people should read this. This was like a brilliant interview, et cetera. But it was also, I wanted people to believe me. And so much of my experience has been just like this low-grade sense of dismissal, pathology, and I've never really known where to place it. And this is from like friends, family, healthcare providers, and the longer that I have been in this state, the more times I get injured. So it's like sometimes it's like multiple times a week. And even now I'm like, did the people believe me? And I'm curious for you, how much, obviously the title of the book suggests that at least in part you go into gender and sexuality. And I've always wondered, as also like a queer and a gender nonconforming person myself, like how much of that pathologization is already hanging over me aside from traumatic brain injury. And I'd be curious to hear you talk about how either in the book itself or in your own lived experience that might exist outside of the book, how you feel like the experience of TBI and how it manifests and the way that you've been, like your experience in the world with it in regard to other people is like gets overlaid or is overlaid by like your experience as like a queer and a genderqueer person in the world. That sort of like pathology that might hang over it.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Jack. Yeah. I mean, it's no, you know, secret that the medical industry already doesn't believe women, people of color, queer people, and so, like, anyone in a marginalized body going to the doctor is already going to have, like, quite a challenge. And I actually really liked my doctor. He was quite good, but there was a lot of talk about, like, this is somaticization, which... I don't know, I'm not a doctor. Let me just first and foremost say I'm not a medical practitioner in any way. I just did my homework. But even he, you know, was sort of like, this is just anxiety, which is complicated because anxiety and depression are byproducts of head injury, but they are not the injury. And so it becomes this kind of issue of intractability, like how do we look at these injuries and the people they're happening to and put those biases, like racist or homophobic or whatever biases, you know, how do we separate that, especially when the sequelae is like very invisible. So I think it's like, unfortunately, a condition that's very, very, it sets itself up to be already disbelieved. And then socio-political context really undermines that even further.
While we go to the next question, I must read to you this favorite part of mine of the book, because you had asked about queerness as it intersected with this book and we didn't get to talk about this. Consciousness not as an individual impulse and perception, but a sense far more cooperative, more connected, a shared experience so essential and intimate we realize that all this time we've been wrong about ourselves. The self is in fact many selves joining together. This, of course, is how queers have always survived. Hiya.
Hi, congratulations, Annie.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, you know, they say writing every book is a journey, and certainly the subject of this book must lend itself to, like, feelings of this is a journey, but would you share with us one or a couple things that really surprised you in the process of working on this manuscript?
Wow, thanks. I mean, the whole thing was a surprise. I think what the biggest surprise is just the urgency, you know, like per Jack's recent comment, like the urgency of people wanting this to be collective knowledge and not individual knowledge or knowledge in like one's own body or in, you know, one's family. I think that there's just, I interviewed a lot of people, I read a lot of testimonies, and you know, the chat boards are like full of it, of their stories of like, I can't stop crying, why can't I stop crying? Or like rage episodes, right? And so I just was like, it was both affirming and surprising that there's just this like great urgency for these narratives to be shared and heard.
Hi, I've really enjoyed listening to you. I also got to hear the interview. I was driving home from Boston on Sunday and podcast, there you were. And I had signed up to see you speak already a month ago. So I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. I'm interested in the relationship with your wife in terms of having to ask for help and accept help, and her position of having to maybe step in as a caretaker. Mm-hmm. And just, you can go wherever you want with that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's a big part of the book, right? Is what does head injury do not only to one person? It's a, you know, it's an isolating experience, but it's not isolated, right? So it affected both me and my wife pretty intensely, right? And there were even moments where we were not sure we were going to make it. And I think it's very, very common to people who, if there's like a relationship where someone's suffering from a chronic illness or an injury, and again, the invisibility stuff just makes it so complicated. So a lot of the kind of grappling with some of the ideas in the book is me sorting through, like, what does it mean to be married, to not only be self-reliant even in a marriage, but ask, you know, have to ask for help. And I'm like not good at that. You know, and also to, for my wife, I think, to like be able to join in something that's like very invisible and unseen. And like I said about the railroad insurance companies, like we've all been socialized to not believe. You know, so what does it mean when pain is invisible for all of us, regardless of the condition? What does it mean to meet your partner where they're at, right? Like people who suffer from migraines or fibromyalgia or whatever, right? Like what does it mean to be in that space when your partner is suffering and you can't see it? And, you know, it's easier to wish it would go away because it would be better for everybody, right? Like you don't want them to be hurt. You want them to spend time with you. And actually part of the book is my wife and I having these conversations. We're like, it's a Q&A where we just have like three or four conversations, and we record it, and I give her a black Sharpie, and I say, like, you can cross out whatever you don't want in the book. And it's a testament to like her love for me that, you know, she was willing to play along. But it felt like I can't write this book and not confront that, because so many people are dealing with that.
Thank you, Annie, again.
Thank you, everybody. It's just so great. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.